We'll hear argument first this morning in number 99-1908, James Alexander versus Martha Sandoval. Mr. Sutton.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. There are two points that I would like to make this morning. The first is that it is never appropriate for a branch of the federal government to imply the creation of a private right of action under the spending power. The second is that regardless of the participation of the state as a defendant in this case, the Court's implied right of action doctrine does not extend to these disparate effect regulations. Let me start with the first point. In case after case over the last 2 to 3 decades, the Court has made clear that states are not run-of-the-mill civil defendants. They're not mere interest groups. They are co-equal sovereigns. And as a result, the Court has not lightly inferred that Congress means to regulate the states as states, to regulate in core areas of local sovereignty, or as here, to expose the states to a private right of action. Those principles are particularly critical when it comes to the spending.
Well, we're not dealing with a damages action here, are we?
That's true, Your Honor. That's
we're dealing with prospective relief.
That's true, Your Honor.
Declaratory and prospective.
Exactly, Your Honor. And, of course, the 11th Amendment applies even to injunctive relief. And even as this particular case reveals, you can still alter the federal-state balance by allowing private rights of action. Indeed, in canon, the Court distinguished a case not unlike this one on just this ground. In canon, in footnote 13, the Court reviewed many of the implied right of action cases it had decided. And it looked at a case called Santa Clara Pueblo, a case in which the Court had not implied a right of action against a tribe. And the reason it did not imply a right of action was because tribes are sovereigns. Now, they're statutory sovereigns, whereas states are constitutional sovereigns.
Mr. Sutton, do I understand what you've just told us to mean that if the Cannon case had been against the state medical school instead of against a private university, there would have been no claim?
I think that's right, Your Honor. And I think that's right. And it would have been, of course, it's an even harder claim here because this claim is under regulations, which is something the Court has never inferred before from congressional action.
That's a different point, but I wanted to know how sweeping your position is. And you are saying that if Cannon had been against the University of Illinois instead of the medical school of the University of Chicago, it would have been thrown out.
That's exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor, and I think that's true, and that is our first principal point. And I think, Your Honor, it follows from all of the cases, whether you look at Gregory versus Ashcroft, Atascadero, South Dakota versus Dole Pennhurst, all of those cases make clear when you alter the federal-state balance, Congress has to be unmistakable in what it's doing. And in this case, it was anything but unmistakable. Everyone agrees.
The canon itself said that's as far as implied rights of action. It said we come from a past when Congress was reacting to the court's activity and knew that the courts were implying private rights of action. I thought canon said this much but no further. Congress, we're now putting you on notice that henceforth, we are not going to imply private rights of action, but we understand that canon comes from a different milieu, and we're not going to change that.
But, Your Honor, states are different. The only case that's been identified so far by respondents involving what seems to be an oxymoron, an implied right of action against a state, is the Allen case from 1969. That was not a spending clause case, point number one. But point number two, more importantly, that's a case that falls under this court's decisions, specifically Atascadero, where you can have an overwhelming implication in the statute that a right of action was created. In Allen, had there not been a right of action, the individuals would not have been able to enforce other parts of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. That case is not a classic implied right of action case where there's no suggestion in the statute that Congress meant to create a right of action. In this case, it's just the opposite. Here, Congress did create a right of action, just not by private individuals, by agencies. So you said my first proposition is a sweeping one, and perhaps it is, but there are not a lot of cases recognizing the implied right of action doctrine against states. I mean, that's not what the Court
true,
has been doing.
That's true, but do you, in your view, do I have your argument correct, that there will be a certain number of civil rights statutes where, in respect to an implied right of action, there is basically silence? and you think there could be a number of those statutes where you would imply from that silence a private right of action against an individual, but not against a state. That's your view.
That may be true, Your Honor, though I do want
to quibble. Is that your view?
It is my view, Your Honor.
Fine. If that's your view, then you're reading a lot of complication into the silence.
And the reason you're saying that is because states will be treated differently from other litigants.
Yes, you're reading all that into a silence. So if you're going to read that much complication into the silence, why not read into it that you could bring injunctive actions but not damage actions, given the 11th Amendment?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, as Justice Powell said in Atascadero, states are different. I mean, to quote him at page 246, given their constitutional role, the states are not like any other class of recipients of federal aid. That's exactly the premise for the Court's clear statement decisions.
Is there any authority for that kind of interpretation of a silence, that we get out of the silence actions against a private person but not actions against a state?
That's exactly Atascadero, where you could get money damages actions against private individuals under Section 504, but not against states. So there is authority for that exact point. But I do want to go back to, I think, a premise in your question, which is that this argument is somehow sweeping because there are lots of other civil rights statutes where somehow there would not now be a right of action against the state. And we're concerned about that. I don't think that's true, however. I don't know what those statutes are. No one's pointed them out. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 itself, Congress was very explicit when it wanted either private rights of action, as in Title II or Title VII, or AG enforcement actions, as in Title III and Title IV. Title VI.
Atascadero, which you put so much reliance on, is distinguishable in that it did involve a money damage action, and it explicitly involved the 11th Amendment. That's not the issue here, is it?
That's true, Your Honor, but as I pointed out, in canon, in footnote 13, the Court has already dealt with this very issue. Santa Clara Pueblo was a case where it was an ex parte Young action against the tribe. What the statute in that case said is we create an express right of action for habeas corpus relief. Said nothing else on the Indian Civil Rights Act. That was the statute at issue. The Court said, in light of the silence, in light of the express creation of one cause of action, silence about any other one, and in light of the sovereignty of the statutory sovereignty of tribes, we're not going to imply a right of action. That's canon itself. And that is this case. If you don't imply rights of action casually against statutory sovereigns, you surely don't do it against constitutional sovereigns.
Would you explain, Mr. Sutton, the impact of the Civil Rights Remedies Equalization Act that I thought waived the 11th Amendment immunity? For Title VI, Title IX, and 504 cases, no?
You're referring to the 1986 Rehabilitation Act amendments? Your Honor, this is a very good point, and we're very sympathetic to it, but I just want to clarify one thing. That point goes to the application of the standard I'm advocating. It does not contest the standard, because what happens in 1986 is Congress shows it understands this dialogue between the Court and Congress as to what is required before you regulate the states in these areas. And I think there's a very good argument that Congress was express in 1986 that there were causes of action against states, but conspicuously missing from those amendments is any indication that there were causes of action under regulations as opposed to the statutory anti-discrimination.
I thought you were speaking sweepingly, that when you answered my question, canon was under the basic prohibition, not against
Title IX, yeah,
right.
Under 901.
Right, and you said there would be no such claim, but now I think you're amending that because you said that after the 86 Act, there would be.
Well, then I misunderstood your question. I thought you were referring to all other cases. I mean, in other words, all statutes that are silent about creating a private right of action, and I am acknowledging the argument is sweeping in that respect. It applies to all statutes. You are right. After 1986, when it comes to Section 504, Title IX, and Title VI, the argument's not sweeping at all when it comes to the anti-discrimination mandate, because as respondents have argued, in 1986, Congress picked up on the dialogue and said, we are going to create an express right of action. So when it comes to intentional discrimination, that which is barred by Title VI or Title IX, there is a right of action. But the critical failing with that particular argument, and I think that's why it's really not being relied upon by respondents, is Congress says nothing at all about rights of action under regulations, which you know, after all, is an extraordinary concept.
What if it were a city who was the — which was the defendant in the case?
In this particular case? Mm-hmm. Well, I think, as this Court has said, cities are different from states. I mean, in my view, cities are they're statutory sovereigns. They're state —
You acknowledge there would be a private right of action for enforcement of the regulations against a city?
There would be with respect to the first argument I'm making, but let me switch now to the second argument we're making, where I do not think there would be a right of action against a city, county, or for that matter, a private person. When one looks at all of the Court's implied right of action cases, whether it's 1964 in the Borak decision or Cannon or more recent decisions, they all start with and agree that the most important point is congressional intent, congressional meaning and design. There are several indicators in Title VI that Congress did not mean to imply the creation of a private right of action under the Section 602 regulations. The first is that as this case comes to the Court, there's no doubt what the anti-discrimination mandate means. Everyone agrees. No one's contesting Bakke, Fordyce, for the view that 601 only prescribes what the Equal Protection Clause prescribes. So first of all, that's a very unusual way for Congress to work, to prescribe one type of state action or city-county action and then somehow implicitly create a cause of action under an entirely different standard of review. The second indicator of congressional intent, it may be helpful to look at the statute itself. And if you look at, if you're interested, if you look at page 1 and 2 of the blue brief, our opening brief, I'd like to point out some language that I think is, well, we're obviously a little biased, but close to dispositive on this particular point. If you're relying on Section 602 to implicitly create this cause of action, you've got to read all of Section 602. Granted, it does create rulemaking authority for the agencies, but if you look on page 2, it's about 8 or 9 lines down, the beginning of a new sentence, you have the sentence that says, compliance with any requirement adopted pursuant to this section may be affected. So once again, compliance with any requirement adopted in accordance with this section. In other words, Section 602 does give rulemaking authority to agencies, but it then says, if you want to enforce those rules, here's how you do it. And the here's how you do it creates special rules when it comes to termination of funding.
Well, it also says, or by any other means authorized by law. So isn't that the issue?
Exactly, Your Honor, and this is critical. The second possibility for getting compliance with these rules is by any other means authorized by law. And as the federal government has acknowledged in its brief, I think at page 11, that includes, for example, injunctive relief. So, for example, under that, at a minimum, all agree an agency could come in and enjoin the state conduct, for example, the way Alabama is administering its driver's licenses. But here's now the critical second statutory point. You then have this proviso exactly after the line that Justice O'Connor has quoted that now says that no such action, the such obviously is referring to everything they've discussed so far, says shall be taken until the department or agency concerned has advised the appropriate person or persons, here the Alabama Department of Public Safety, of the failure to comply with the requirement is determined that compliance cannot be secured by voluntary means. How in the world could a private individual establish that a state is in compliance with a federal agency rule? That's not
One way the two could be reconciled, and I'm not suggesting that it's the best way, but one way to reconcile them would be to say that the private right of action is contingent upon the states having taken the steps in the proviso, so that until the state had notified and until there had been some conclusion drawn that voluntary compliance would not be reached in the absence of action, the private party could not seek the injunction.
But, Your Honor, let's take the most virtuous and earnest state attorney general. They're faced with one of these private enforcement actions, and the private litigant does what you're suggesting. They first put them on notice. They send a letter. Listen, we don't think what you're doing is permissible under
these rules. Well, I was
suggesting
something perhaps even more awkward. I was suggesting that the private litigant couldn't go ahead until the state agency had said, you know, you're out of compliance, and the state agency had come to some conclusion that voluntary compliance was, in fact, not feasible. At that point, the individual could then go ahead with the suit. And one of the predicates for the private injunctive suit would be the state has tried to get voluntary compliance and it can't.
And the point, I guess the point I'm making is that take the ideal state attorney general. They get this lawsuit and the private individual says, listen, we'd like to give you an opportunity to voluntarily comply and here's how we suggest you do it. What assurance, what guarantee is there that the state is now in compliance with a federal agency's rules?
Mr. Sutton, look at the sentence. Provided, however, that no such action shall be taken until the department or agency concerned. Does the phrase department or agency there refer to the federal department or agency in question?
It does, Your Honor, and this is a better point than the one I'm making in response to Justice Souter. That language makes it clear who is the one that's doing the advising. And if we're going to draw any inferences from this statutory scheme, it's an inference that whatever could be done under Section 601, under Section 602, that was an enforcement provision for agencies. Enforcement provision in the sense that they could promulgate rules to effectuate Section 601, and then they could go about enforcing them. But as the Chief Justice's question points out, it is the federal department or agency that they're referring to.
Oh, I guess my question implied, I think that is certainly the easier reading. But I guess I also think that if we felt otherwise compelled to recognize the private action here based on other principles, I don't suppose this would necessarily stand in the way of it.
Mr. Sutton, you think the word compliance talks about private actions as well as actions by the federal government? I always thought that sentence referred to compliance may be affected as by the federal government may affect it in this way. That isn't talking about private actions, is it? Do you read it that way?
I do, Your Honor.
In other words, you think there's an express cause of action and rather than implied cause of action under Title VI.
Here's the reason I read it this way, and I want to make sure I'm answering the question.
Do you think there's an express cause of action under Title VI?
I think there's a very good argument that there is an overwhelming implication after 1986 that there is a cause of action under Section 601.
No, that's not my question. The question is, do you think there's an express cause of action under this, as opposed to one that we found in canon that Congress intended to imply a cause of action?
Are you referring to 602 or 601?
602.
I think there's a very good argument that there is an express cause of action for all of Title VI after 1986, so post-canon. I think that there is a very good argument for that. Again, it requires implications, but I think that falls under the Atascadero point that if it's a sufficiently overwhelming implication, then we're going to recognize it. After all, in 1986, they didn't create a right of action. All they did is they said, we're abrogating the state immunity. But I want to make sure I'm understanding a point that I'm not sure I addressed, and this goes back to the compliance sentence about 9 lines down on page 2. It says compliance with any requirement adopted according to the section, and I don't know how one can read that to say you don't follow these rules when you try to obtain compliance.
Well, one could read it to say that sentence just refers to actions instituted by the federal government.
But compliance actions,
which is a fairly normal way to refer to.
Well, maybe this is my confusion. When it says any requirement adopted according to this section, the requirement's referring to the rules. Section 602 does two things. It says you can promulgate rules, number one, and number two, you can go out and enforce them. And it does seem to me that requirement language is referring to the requirements promulgated under the section. And so, anyway, I may be wrong, but that is the way we think we read it, and we certainly think, given a requirement of clarity, at a minimum, it's not unambiguous the other way. I mean, that seems to me quite striking. If I could shift to a few other points. There are some other indicators.
Do you concede that Congress has authorized the regulations at issue here?
No, Your Honor, we do not. And we think the better reading is that these regulations are invalid. But as we indicated in our opening brief and our reply, we don't think the Court needs to address the validity of the regulations. Certainly that would
Let's assume that the regulations are permitted. Make that assumption. That, then, is simply an implementation of 601. It has to be under the – or we have a delegation problem.
Well, Your Honor, that's a possibility, but you still have the problem of of the rules of the language in Section 602 that I just referred to that suggest indicates that all of those rules were rules that agencies were to enforce, not private individuals. So even if you decided, and I don't think you need to decide this, but even if you decided the rules were valid, it would still be rules that could be enforced by the agencies. In other words, if you thought...
But the substantive obligation that the state must meet is a 601 obligation, as interpreted by the agency under 602.
Absolutely.
Why can't you say the suit is under 601?
Well, I don't think anyone agrees. I want to be clear, but I don't think anyone agrees that this suit can be characterized as being under 601.
I understand that, but I want to know why.
And the reason is that the court has already made clear that Section 601 does not cover disparate effect legislation. And as Justice O'Connor and Justice Powell indicated in Guardians, one does not effectuate a statutory anti-discrimination mandate by redefining it.
But once the regulation is in place, doesn't the statute then have a new meaning as interpreted by the agency?
No.
Or else why does the agency have authority to do this at all?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor.
As a preventative measure?
The most that could be said is that you would be enforcing at that point Section 602. And Section 602 is the part of the statute that gives the agency's rulemaking authority. I mean, that's the way respondents have characterized their action. That's the way the lower court characterized their action.
Would the agency not have had any rulemaking authority without Section 602? Wouldn't it have had the ability to promulgate interpretive regulations?
That is possible.
Setting forth what its own view of the anti-intentional discrimination provision of 601 was?
That's true, and that's not the way the case has been argued. But if that were true, then I think it's fair you would need to look at whether that's a legitimate interpretation of Section 601.
Right, and under our case law, it wouldn't be.
Absolutely not, because the Chevron deference...
So the only way the regulation here is valid is on the assumption that it is not an interpretive regulation, but rather is a regulation that goes beyond the meaning of 601 in a prophylactic way to, as 602 puts it, to effectuate the provisions of 601.
That's exactly right. And there's some guidance in the court's case. In fact, it even comes from the line of authority in which respondents are relying, and that's the securities cases. There have been many cases under Section 10B and under Rule 10B-5 where plaintiffs have attempted to bring a cause of action that broadens Section 10B. The most notable of them is Central Bank from just six terms ago. Another one, Ernst & Ernst versus Hockelder in 1976, were both situations in which the private litigants attempted to create a cause of action under Rule 10B-5, which actually has an even broader source of statutory authority, and the court rejected them because they created a cause of action that contained fewer elements than the statutory right of action. And I think that's a good analogy
here.
The
same true of Rule 14?
Excuse me?
The proxy rules, the statute and the proxy rules, is the same what you're saying now?
Well, Your Honor, that, of course, is the O'Hagan case that you wrote for the court in 1997. I want to make sure I'm answering your question.
Yes.
Under Rule 14E3, you've got a different statutory authorization of rulemaking power. There, the operative language is that the agency can promulgate rules that, quote, prevent the underlying prohibition.
The regulation there, the rule, went beyond the statute. It was kind of like a prophylactic. And I don't know, perhaps you can tell me, if there's any other instance of splitting the regulation from the statute. I mean, the private right of action, the 10b-5 action, the Rule 14 action, they're all wedded to a statutory text, and as far as I know, there's no distinction between, I'm bringing it under Rule 10b and not rather than the statute, or Rule 14 and rather than the statute.
Your Honor, I couldn't agree more, and I don't think there is precedent for that point. I mean, that I think is our main point, that as the case comes to the court, we all know what Section 601 means, and that's why they have to characterize.
But that's on your argument that the regulation is invalid. If the regulation is valid, then it seemed to me to be just like Rule 14.
But Your Honor, the implied right of action inquiry is an inquiry that goes really to the same question that you ask when you decide whether an agency rule is valid, and that's what did Congress mean? What did Congress authorize here? So it's true, if there's not an implied right of action, it may make these regulations of dubious validity, but that's not necessarily true. The federal government.
If I understand your argument, you're saying even the government couldn't bring this action.
If the regulations are invalid, that's true.
Your position is they are invalid, therefore the government couldn't bring the action either.
We do think they're not valid, but I want to make clear, we think that's a harder.
We don't need to worry about all the argument about implied cause of action and all the rest if the regulation's invalid.
Well, that is one way to proceed, and we've argued that they're not valid. That is an easier way to proceed. I'd like to.
That's not the question for which we took the case, and I'm assuming, and will assume that the regulations are valid. Now, is it your position that if the agency promulgated a regulation that was an interpretive regulation, which was not precluded by our prior case law? Namely, it didn't say that you don't have to have intentional discrimination, but it said this is what intentional discrimination consists of. And that regulation is within the bounds of reasonableness that would satisfy Chevron. Is it your position that that regulation also would not be able to be vindicated by a private right of action?
That's a harder case, Your Honor, but the reason I think the way to look at it is, does the text unambiguously create this right? If the text doesn't do it, I don't know how a rule can do it.
The text cannot unambiguously create a right for the agency to issue a Chevron-based rule which is premised upon an ambiguity in the statute. I mean,
Your Honor, you're right.
The agency has no Chevron power unless there's an ambiguity in the statute.
This question gets to the distinction between my first argument and my second. When it comes to the creation of an implied right of action against the state, the court has always said it's about what's in the text. So if it's the state as a defendant, then I stick with what I just say.
Okay.
If it's a private party, city, or county, then I do not.
It doesn't matter to you whether it's an interpretive rule or a substantive rule. You can't apply it against the state in a private right of action.
That's exactly right. If I could reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Sutton. Mr. Schnapper, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the petitioners in this case are proposing substantial changes in the law in a number of distinct areas. First, they characterize this case as involving a fundamental change in federal-state relations requiring a particularly clear and explicit statement that Congress intends to do that. This is a classic ex parte Young injunction. It's an injunction against Mr. Alexander in his official capacity to restrain future violations of the law. This Court held in Will that is precisely the kind of remedy that is not.
In what case, Mr.
Will versus Department of Corrections. That is precisely the kind of legislation that does not fundamentally disturb federal-state relations. And I think the whole line of cases since Ex parte Young simply could not survive if that were the law. Secondly,
that handles the 11th Amendment argument, but it doesn't handle the spending clause argument, the argument that any conditions you're imposing upon the states under the spending clause have to be clear.
To which I'm about to turn. Mr. Sutton next suggests that there cannot be an implied cause of action in spending clause legislation, that any cause of action in spending clause legislation has to be explicit. If that is right, Canon and Guardians were wrongly decided. That spending clause legislation, Guardians, is this very statute. They both recognize an implied cause of action. And that whole line of cases would have to be overruled.
Well, what was Canon? I thought that was Title VII.
Title IX.
So that's strictly spending
clause. Strictly spending clause.
And Canon did not involve a regulation, right? Involved that was a claim under the substantive standard itself.
The specific claim in Canon was actually an effect claim. The plaintiff was a woman who asserted that the university's practice of rejecting medical school applicants over a particular age had a discriminatory effect.
Right. But the university wasn't a state university; it was a private university.
Yes, I understand. I understand.
Well, that's sort of crucial to the spending clause argument here, isn't it?
It's not.
I don't think our cases say that even when you're using your spending clause power to give
private individuals the rights to some federal money, you have to be clear. I thought we only have said that when you're giving money to the states under the spending clause, you have to be clear.
I'm about to turn to the state issue, but I think a fair reading of the I think the spending clause argument would encompass private defendants.
The spending clause argument is as I understand it, addressed the fact that you're trying to make a state a defendant, so canon can't be dispositive of that.
If the spending clause rules are limited in that fashion, then that would be correct.
Thought you said to accept the spending clause, it meant that canon had been wrongly decided.
Well, if you were to conclude that the spending clause limitations don't apply to private parties or to cities at all, then that problem would be solved. But the next problem would not, because this court has been applying this implied cause of action to state defendants. It did so in Bazemore against Friday and in Alexander against Choate. Those were classic ex parte Young injunctions against state officials, and the court had no hesitation in applying.
Did it explicitly decide the question, or did it just assume it in those cases?
I think it's fair to say that it assumed it, as have the lower courts for years. I mean, this is an established part of the fabric of the law, and it has been for many years.
Did either of those cases involve regulations as the immediate premise for the suit?
Both.
Both did?
In Bazemore, we relied on a Title VI regulation, and in Alexander, we relied on a Section 504 regulation.
In other words, you're saying that if you take the silence, I'm trying to follow the complicated. If you take the silence, and if you either read the silence as a whole, just private rights of action against states and individuals for damages and injunctions, or you try to create epicycles or split the atom. And if you're going to split that atom of silence, and if you split it to distinguish between state and private defendants, then you should also split the state defendants to distinguish between injunctive actions and damage actions. At least that's what you'd have authority for under case law, because you have some cases, injunctions versus states, and you have other cases, damages versus private.
Right.
Is that right?
That is right. In our view, the provisions of the 11th Amendment and the sort of penumbra of the 11th Amendment issue and will exhaust the federalism problems that are applicable in a situation like this. And when you get to an ex parte Young injunction, that problem no longer exists.
Mr. Schnapper, the two cases that you said did involve regulations, Bazemore and Alexander, was it?
Yes.
Did they involve a regulation that could not possibly have been an interpretive regulation? See, I mean, that's what's distinctive about this. About this case. Here we have a regulation that cannot possibly represent the agency's view of what the statute, 601, requires, because we've said what 601 requires, and it doesn't require this. Now, did those either of those two cases involve that kind of a regulation?
They did not. I mean, there wasn't an authoritative determination of what the scope of the statute was in the context in which those regulations were invoked. The petitioners have suggested that there can never be an implied cause of action to enforce a regulation, or I would have to say here as well a rule, because that's really where this has come up, that contains a prohibition not contained in the statute itself. This court has done that on two occasions. In Borak versus GI case, which was decided shortly before the announcement of the adoption of this statute, the court recognized an implied cause of action to enforce part of Rule 14. And then in the superintendent of insurance case, 7 years later, the court did the same thing with regard to Rule 10b-5. Those are implied cause of actions to enforce.
Those were a long time ago, weren't they, Mr. Schnapper?
Yes, but the court has continued to recognize that cause of action. And in any event, those decisions reflected the standard for implied cause of actions that were prevailing at the time the 1964 Civil Rights Act was adopted. And it's been the practice of this court in addressing the question of whether it would imply a cause of action to look at the law that existed when the statute was adopted, on the presumption that Congress would have intended whatever result would follow from the then prevailing law.
Oh, be it 64 or the 86. I mean, you're relying to some extent on much later amendments to the Act. I mean, that's a substantial part of your case, isn't it?
We have a variety of
arguments. At least
by
the time those amendments were adopted, those earlier cases were subject to considerable
right.
doubt.
But we think that an implied cause of action was appropriate under the 64 Act as written.
Without resort to the 86.
Without resort to the 86 Act. Finally, with regard to the suggestion of petitioners, they've urged quite specifically that a regulation cannot forbid action not forbidden by the statute itself. The Court has addressed that question on several occasions. In Mourning versus Family Publication Service with regard to the Truth in Lending Law, and in Jemskill versus Walling, 1946 decision with regard to the minimum wage. Both cases involved prohibitions containing regulations which clearly went beyond the language of the statute. Both cases, they were upheld by this Court. And Jemskill, again, was the prevailing law at the time that Congress authorized regulations in Section 602. And so it seems to me that's appropriate to look to here. With regard to the argument regarding the limitations on the preconditions for certain actions under Section 602, this Court has addressed that question already in canon. It's important to note here that Congress clearly intended that the limitations in Section 602 on agency action would apply in a discriminatory intent case. Indeed, that was a particular focus. Intentional discrimination was a particular focus in 1964. The one thing that's certain is that Congress didn't intend to permit an agency to cut off a state agency or a city agency or a private entity from federal funding without going through all the loops set up in Section 602. That is to say, Section 602 applies even where we're dealing with a Section 601 violation. So the Court had that problem before it in canon. And this very argument was made. It was made in Justice White's dissent in canon. It was made in Justice White's opinion in Bakke. It was made in Justice Powell's dissent in Guardians. It was made by the defendant.
Which argument do you say
that,
was made?
I'm sorry. That the notice and predetermination clause of Section 602 would be evaded if you allowed a private cause of action, because private parties don't make those, you know, can't or don't do those things. That very argument was made in all three cases, and it's never been accepted by the Court. Indeed, specifically, was rejected by the Court.
But when you start talking about guardians, to suggest that it hasn't been accepted, really nothing was accepted. Nothing much was accepted in guardians. There were so many different opinions.
With all respect, there were three different issues in guardians, two of which were clearly resolved, one of which was opaque. The question of whether there was an implied cause of action was clearly resolved. There were six members of the Court who ruled that there was. The question of the validity of the regs was expressly resolved. Five members of the Court addressed it and resolved it. What was unresolved was the scope of the remedy in one of those cases. That
yes,
was the issue.
But the reasoning of the various opinions was not identical. In those cases where there was a holding, there was not any general majority accepted reasoning.
I think the reasoning with regard to the first two issues I mentioned was perfectly consistent.
Well, then why were there different opinions?
Because there were differing views as to the. As to other issues. There was a difference about whether Section 601 covered intent, which separated Justice White and Justice Marshall from Justices Stevens, Brennan, and Blackmun. So they had to write different opinions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schnapper. General Waxman, we'll hear from you.
Give me a little room here. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, for over 25 years, courts have afforded injunctive relief against violations of Title VI regulations, against state officials as well as other public officials and private officials. That practice is consistent with the expectations of the Congress that enacted Title VI, particularly considering the legal and social context that existed in 1964, and successive Congresses have validated the private right of action.
What social context existed in 1964?
Well, among other things, Mr. Chief Justice, the persistent practice of many local jurisdictions in evading the dictates of this court and of Congress with respect to a variety of civil rights issues, the most prominent
you're
one
you're
would
referring
be,
to what was what various local jurisdictions were doing at the time.
Yes, local and state jurisdictions. For example, the kind of thing that prompted the Voting Rights Act of 65.
Can you say anything about it's 35 years, and you said in 35 years everyone has assumed that there is a private right of action for injunctive relief based on a regulation under Title VI. But have there only been like one or two in 35 years, or have there been a lot, or is this the first time it's come up, or the second time, or
are you talking
you say
about
anything
against states or generally speaking?
Because well, let's
the
say against
yes
a governmental body, however you want to answer it. I'm just trying to get an empirical idea of whether people really this really is embedded in the public mind or not.
I think that it is utterly embedded. The cases, the decided cases, are collected in two appendices to Mr. Schnapper's brief. But with respect to states in particular, I mean, let me speak first to the regulations issue and then to the states issue, which I take to be the state of Alabama's principal points. There is no case of which I am aware in which this court has ever even suggested, much less held, that in determining the scope of a right of action, whether express or implied, that a distinction should be made between rights articulated in a statute itself and rights articulated in substantive regulations that the statute mandates that the agency promulgate. This
well,
is a
one,
separation
one,
of powers issue.
General, I think I agree with the proposition you start with, but one reason to look at it differently now would be this. We have, since the statute was passed, we have taken a different and at least in the minds of some of us a more realistic view of the circumstances in which you really can, in fact, infer a congressional intent to provide to recognize a private right of action. So we're trying to preserve Congress's expectations with respect to the law that was passed under the earlier regime, but it's also sensible for us not to expand that earlier regime any further than it necessarily has to go based upon the precedent that the Congress might have assumed. And therefore, there may be a good reason, simply because this is no longer the world of Case and Borak, to draw just the kind of distinction which you point out we never have drawn before, but which we have never recognized, but which we have never precluded drawing before.
I would like to make two points, Justice Souter, in response to that observation, with which I agree. First of all, the implication of drawing the kind of distinction that's been suggested here has very, very broad ramifications beyond enforcement of civil rights statutes. If you look at the cases, either implied or under 1983, in which private parties have sought to enforce against state agencies obligations under the Medicare and Medicaid statutes, those are regulatory obligations. The contemporary legal context in which Title VI and the other civil rights provisions of the 64 Act were enacted, as this Court recognized in Canon, and in particular in then-Justice Rehnquist's separate opinion in Canon, were enacted in a regime in which it was understood that legislative silence with respect to a statute that created substantive rights for the benefit of individuals would be enforced by the courts in an implied right of action. And that existed in regulatory cases. We've talked about Borak. Merrill Lynch was decided somewhat later in 1982.
None of those, though, were against states.
Well, no. It's quite right that those weren't against states, and Mr. Schnapper has cited some of the Title VI and Title IX cases that have operated against states. My only point on distinguishing between regulations and statutes for purpose of implying a right of action is that you will run into this Court's decided case law under the Medicare and Medicaid statutes, whether under implied rights of action or under 1983, the Wright, Wilder, Blessing, Souter.
Were those regulations that you're concerned about regulations that plainly went beyond an interpretation of the statute?
They were.
See, I mean, that's what's distinct about this case. In addition to the fact that it involves a state, you have a regulation that cannot possibly be characterized as simply an agency interpretation of the statute. Now, are the Medicare regulations that you're talking about of that genre?
I wish I were more expert in Medicare and Medicaid regulations. My understanding.
I wish I were, too.
I will gladly take guidance from you, Justice Scalia, on this, but I believe that those statutes, like others in 1983 actions against state officials, involved both substantive and interpretive regulations. And, of course, if you were going to draw a distinction here, it would drive a wedge right through the heart of this Court's cases, including Chrysler Corporation versus Brown and Chevron, that hold that substantive regulations that are mandated by statute have the force of law. Let me go to the state point, the notion that
states — my only thought, they may have the force of law, but they may not have the force of the unequivocal for purposes of the spending clause.
Well, I don't think I can do better than simply to repeat the point I hope that I had made, which is there is no case suggesting that for purposes of enforcing a spending clause obligation, there is a distinction in recognizing a cause of action based on a statute or on regulations that the funding agency is mandated to put forward. The principle
of there's no case suggesting that there isn't either. I mean, I think Justice Souter's point was that this is an area where there is no precise authority one way or the other.
Correct. What we have on our side is, I believe, a completely unbroken practice of enforcing obligations under both the spending clause and otherwise, equally whether they arise within the four corners of the statute or under substantive regulations that are mandated by the statute. Now, I understand that our position puts great weight on the validity of these regulations, but that point, as the Court of Appeals noted, was expressly conceded by the state below, and we don't think that it's at issue here. With respect to the implication of an implied private right of action against a state official, which was Mr. Sutton's first point, Mr. Schnapper cited some of the cases under Title VI and its cognate statutes. But I think it's also important to recognize not only the long line of 1983 cases, many of which enforce spending clause statutes and their regulations in injunctive action, but also the point that Justice Kennedy made in his dissent in Golden State Transit for himself and Justice O'Connor and the Chief Justice, which is that there may be instances in which a healthy disagreement may arise as to whether a particular provision of federal law creates a right, privilege, or immunity. But when what is being sought is injunctive relief, prospective relief only, against a state official, the courts have long recognized a cause of action under the Supremacy Clause, Sections 1331 and 2201, including in Spending Clause cases, which we have cited and discussed probably too briefly in footnote 12 of our brief. Cases like Blum versus Bacon and Lead Deadwood are Spending Clause cases. Blum was even involved a regulation in which a suit was brought by a private party against a state official saying, look, the state has a policy, it's reflected in a regulation or a statute, that operates in a manner that's inconsistent with federal law, and therefore it is preempted. And the background principle, the principle of law I respectfully submit that Mr. Sutton is advocating runs directly contrary to the particular cases we cited under Title VI and its cognate statutes and 1983, but also this more underlying long line of cases that includes but goes well beyond spending clause precedents. Our position fundamentally in this case is that for 25 years, it is true, Mr. Chief Justice, that there is not a holding directly on point that says you may have a private right of action to enforce the Title VI regulations, but for 25 years at least, there has been a shared understanding among the three branches reflected in a unanimous set of body of case law from the federal courts, from successive congressional enactments, in addition to the Attorney's Fees Amendment, the Rehabilitation Act amendments, and the Civil Rights Restoration Act. Congress has enacted 11 cognate civil rights statutes in which the funding agencies are expressly directed to promulgate regulations patterned after those under Title VI, all against a backdrop in which, at least since Lau versus Nichols, and running up to the present, implied rights of action against state public agencies and other public agencies have been adjudicated. And the executive branch, across administrations, I've pulled out briefs filed on behalf of the United States by my predecessors, Robert Bork and Rex Lee, explaining to the court that the implied private right of action to enforce these cases, and I believe that the former one was in Alexander, which was a case against a state, are important for an important complement to federal enforcement officials. Our brief in Darone said, quote, the award of individual relief to a private litigant who has prosecuted her own suit is not only sensible, but is fully consistent with, and in some cases even necessary, to the orderly enforcement of the statute. If there are no further questions, we'll submit.
Thank you, General Waxman. Mr. Sutton, you have 3 minutes remaining.
A few brief points, Your Honor. In terms of the question of what vantage point the court uses in looking at this issue, there are many cases from the 80s and 90s where the court has not looked to the date in which the statute was enacted for determining whether there's implied right of action. Touche Ross, involving the 1934 Securities Act, is the very same statute that Borak involved, and it didn't look back in time. It followed what the court was doing at that point in time. Same is true of Transamerica, California versus Sierra Club, Northwest Airlines. Even Canon itself applied the Court versus Ash test, which came 4 years after Title IX. Now, as for the question whether Guardians has resolved this, the last thing Guardians resolved was the question of whether there was an implied right of action. Even if one allowed for the counting of dissents and plurality votes, you only had two justices agreeing there was an implied private right of action in Guardians. So that surely was not decided there. And the notion that pre-1983 there were settled expectations on this point can't possibly be true. Look at Justice Marshall's opinion in Guardians. Footnote 1 identifies the split in lower court authority on the very question the court tried to resolve but didn't. So that doesn't seem possible. As far as the preemption cases that the federal government is relying on, I think it's footnote 11 or 12 in its brief, that's a very different issue. The question of whether a properly promulgated rule would preempt state law is one issue. It's a second issue whether a private individual can enforce it. I have no other points. Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well, Mr. Sutton. The case is submitted.